this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Tracy Wise, Senior Vice President, Investor Relations. Please go ahead, Ms. Wise.
Thank you, operator, and good morning. Thank you all for joining us for Brookfield Infrastructure Partners' second quarter 2014 earnings conference call. On the call today is Bahir Manios, our Chief Financial Officer, and Sam Pollock, our Chief Executive Officer. Following their remarks, we look forward to taking your questions and comments. At this time, I would like to remind you that in responding to questions and in talking about our growth initiatives and our financial and operating performance, we may make forward-looking statements. These statements are subject to known and unknown risks, and future results may differ materially. For future information on known risk factors, I would encourage you to review our annual report on Form 20-F, which is available on our website. With that, I would like to turn the call over to Bahir Manios. Bahir?
Thanks, Tracy, and good morning, everyone. In my remarks, I'll focus on funds from operations, or FFO, which is a proxy for cash that we generate in our business. Our results for the quarter were strong, with most of our operating businesses performing well. We reported funds from operations, or FFO, of $180 million, or 86 cents per unit, which translates to a 62% payout ratio that sits comfortably at the lower end of our long-term target range. For the first half of the year, our results were up 12% on a comparable or same-store annualized FFO per unit basis, surpassing our targeted goal of 6-9% of organic growth that gets generated without additional fresh capital from BIP. For the quarter, our results were flat compared to the prior year, as the second quarter of 2013 benefited from the contribution of assets that were subsequently sold as part of our capital recycling initiative. Our utilities business generated FFO of $92 million in the period, compared with $83 million on a comparable basis and $96 million in total for the second quarter of 2013. Total results in this segment were lower, reflecting the impact of the sale of our Australasian distribution operations in the fourth quarter of 2013. However, the comparable results were strong, as our businesses benefited from higher connection activity in our UK regulated distribution business, inflation indexation, a larger regulated asset base, and lower costs resulting from margin improvement programs at a number of our operations. Our transport business generated FFO of $94 million in the second quarter of 2014, compared to $83 million in the prior year period. The increase in FFO was driven largely by the greater contribution from our Brazilian toll roads, where we doubled our ownership in September 2013, as well as stronger results in our ports business, where we benefited from both the newly acquired North American West Coast port operation and better performance at our European port operations. This increase in FFO was partially offset by $6 million of non-recurring interest income from a favorable stamp duty ruling at our Australian railroad that was reflected in prior year results. Our energy business generated FFO of $16 million in the second quarter of 2014, compared to $18 million in the prior year period. Results were negatively impacted by lower transportation volumes in our North American gas transmission business and a warmer winter that affected volumes in our UK energy distribution business. On the financing front, subsequent to period end, our Chilean electricity transmission business completed a $375 million financing comprised of notes that were rated Baa1 by Moody's and BBB by Standard & Poor's. The issuance, which was almost seven times oversubscribed, has an 11-year term and a coupon of 4.25%. The proceeds from this financing will be used to repay debt that is maturing in the second half of 2014 and 2015. From an operations perspective, most of our businesses performed well during the quarter, and we're encouraged on a number of fronts. Most noteworthy was our Australian regulated terminal, where we experienced record capacity utilization of over 95% in June. Given that we have take-or-pay contracts in place with premier mining companies, our financial results for this business are not impacted by volumes handled at the terminal. However, this level of throughput is encouraging as it demonstrates that in this low price environment, our customers are continuing to ship significant volumes through the terminal. Our railroads saw another good quarter with volumes up 5% from the prior year as a result of higher iron ore and grain shipments, which were ahead of our expectations. And finally, our ports business also experienced a solid quarter with results improving compared to the prior year. The business in the UK has seen an overall 15% increase in underlying volumes on a year-to-date basis compared to the prior year, primarily due to improved economic conditions and several customers expanding their operations. In response to increased demand from our customers, we're investing $35 million to complete an upgrade of the quay to accommodate these increased volumes. In addition, we're in the midst of integrating our North American West Coast container terminal into our ports platform. We expect to see a meaningful contribution from this business with the completion of its modernization program at the end of 2015. And finally, on the organic growth front, as you know, this is a core part of our overall strategy, and we've continued to add to our backlog in our utilities, transport, and energy businesses during the quarter. These are all projects that are funded by internally generated cash flows and earn us very attractive risk-adjusted returns. As an example, this quarter in our utilities business, we grew our committed projects backlog during the second quarter to approximately $435 million, which we expect to invest and commission into our regulated rate base in the next 24 months. We did that by adding almost $100 million of projects, primarily at our UK regulated distribution business and our Australian regulated terminal. Our UK regulated distribution business experienced record sales activity during the period, with sales of our multi-product offerings up 40% compared to the prior year. The increase in activity levels is primarily attributable to a broader recovery in the UK housing market, which still remains below pre-financial crisis levels. Also, at our Australian regulated terminal, we received approval to invest an additional $50 million on the final phase of a storm water management system. With that, I'll turn the call over to Sam.
Thanks, Bahir, and good morning, everyone. The focus of my remarks today will be on updating our investment activities, and I thought I'd review our investment posture for you. Last quarter, we indicated that approximately $450 million of capital was committed to be deployed into four new investments. We've made considerable progress towards closing these transactions and expect them to start to contribute to our results during the second half of the year. In mid-August, we expect to close on our investments in VLI and Macquarie District Energy, as we have received all consents required for closing these transactions. BLI is a Brazilian rail and port business, which will provide us with approximately $300 million of organic growth projects, as the business has a substantial capital program to expand operations. Macquarie District Energy is a district energy system that provides environmentally efficient heating and cooling to large buildings in Chicago and Las Vegas. We are still waiting for regulatory consent to close our investment in the Elizabeth Container Terminal located in the Port of New York, New Jersey, and the acquisition of Seattle Steam. We expect to obtain the required consents during the second half of 2014. Just after quarter end, we signed an agreement to acquire Lodi Gas Storage in California with institutional partners for $105 million. Our equity investment will be 40% or approximately $40 million. While this is a modest investment, we believe we are acquiring the business for exceptional value. This business complements our existing natural gas storage business, and we expect to achieve some synergies from combining with our current platform. We expect this transaction to close by the end of the first quarter of 2015, following completion of customary closing conditions. I would now like to discuss our investment posture, as lately we've had a recurring question from a number of our investors regarding how much longer the investment cycle for infrastructure assets will last before we see a correction in values. While our views don't necessarily lead to a simple answer, we can certainly see an argument for both sides of the debate. For those of us with GDP-sensitive operations in North America and Europe, it certainly feels like the recovery in economic growth is just beginning. Our European ports business has only recently shown improvement with increases in container traffic and signs of new customer investment activity, particularly in our UK operations. Furthermore, in both the UK and the US, we're still not seeing housing starts at levels that approach the steady state levels we would expect. Consequently, we should still experience stronger economic growth for a number of years to come, which will support valuations and encourage further investment. But you can also take the view that we are late in the investment cycle. The stock market in the U.S. and Canada is well into its fifth year of strength. There have been a recent spate of IPOs by companies looking to exit core assets, and the use of leverage and valuation multiples in a number of notable mergers and acquisitions are approaching levels we haven't seen since 2005 and 2007. These are all indicators of a cycle nearing its conclusion. Now, no one can say for certain how much longer the cycle will last or what sort of correction we could experience once interest rates start their climb from these historic levels. Our view is that valuation levels for some types of assets have been inflated by a combination of extremely low interest rates and a scarcity of infrastructure opportunities to satisfy the investment appetite of new market entrants. On the other hand, we also believe that the global economy will likely surprise on the upside, which should mitigate these factors from a valuation perspective. Our businesses are not liquid investments, and therefore we take a much longer-term approach to investing than many investors. As a result, our investment and financial strategy is formulated to succeed throughout the business cycle, including conditions which currently exist. However, we believe that several of our investment guidelines are particularly relevant in this valuation environment, and therefore I wanted to reiterate five of these guidelines to you. First and foremost, we remain focused on investing capital to meet our long-term return targets of 12 to 15%. We do not believe in reducing our return thresholds for the sake of making it easier to acquire assets, nor do we justify purchases based solely on our accretive cost of capital. Second, we create value for our unitholders by being both good buyers and good sellers. Late last year, we recycled over $1 billion of equity capital in our business through asset sales. While we don't expect that we'll be selling assets every year, harvesting assets to reinvest back into our business is a core strategy. Investing capital at 12 to 15% returns and selling assets at an 8 to 10% return level is very accretive to our company's per unit growth. Third, we don't pay for unrealistic growth targets. Whenever we look to make an acquisition, the seller will always portray a very rosy future for the business. We apply our expertise to forecast a reasonable expectation for growth that reflects competitive dynamics such as new market entrants and regulatory considerations. This is where many acquisition mistakes are made, in particular when capital is more freely available. Fourth, we buy high-quality assets with established, proven business models and management teams that have a solid track record. We're always focused on identifying businesses with internally generated organic growth potential where we can deploy further capital at highly accretive returns. Furthermore, in an environment where odds favor interest rates increasing, assets that are fully contracted with little organic growth are the most susceptible to valuation declines. And lastly, we maintain a high level of liquidity. We currently have approximately $2.5 billion of total liquidity. We've also extended the maturity profile of our debt to an average of 10 years and, for the most part, fixed our interest rates. While we incur some cost for maintaining high levels of liquidity and utilizing long-term fixed-rate debt, we believe the benefits of being in position to take advantage of market corrections far outweigh these costs. I'm going to conclude my remarks with an outlook for our business. We have built a business over the past number of years that is positioned to deliver solid results in a variety of economic environments. We are currently operating in global economic conditions that are generally pretty good. The U.S. economy has continued to demonstrate signs of renewed growth, and we've also seen further easing of monetary policy by the European Central Bank. There are continued signs of economic stabilization within China, where government officials recently expressed confidence that the government would achieve the 7.5% annual GDP growth target established late last year. The only region where we operate that has seen economic growth decelerate is South America. However, we believe fundamentals continue to support favorable growth over the longer term. On the whole, our business should perform well in this economic environment. We remain disciplined with our capital allocation and underwriting. Liquidity is strong, and our business development teams are continuing to engage on a number of attractive investment opportunities. In addition, we have almost $1 billion of organic investment opportunities in our operations, which are always the lowest risk and highest return for us. With that, I'll turn the call back to the operator to open the line for questions.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touchtone phone. You will hear a tone to indicate you're in queue. For participants using a speakerphone, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing any keys. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. There will be a brief moment while we poll for questions. The first question today is from Brendan Majerana with Wells Fargo. Please go ahead.
Oh, thanks. Good morning. Sam, so at DBCT, you guys had record utilization. What do you think that means for the prospects for additional growth CapEx at your Australian rail operations? And could you also maybe speak to, does the high utilization do anything to rekindle the opportunity at Dungeon Point as well?
Let me just write these down for a second. Okay. So, hi, Brendan. The first comment I'm making on the higher volumes we're seeing at DBCT, I think the reason we're seeing that is because all the mining companies right now are, you know, highly focused on bringing down their per unit costs, and so they're focused on maximizing volumes and, you know, achieving those economies of scale. And so that's why, you know, we think we're seeing this phenomenon take place in this particular environment. And so we would expect that to continue for the foreseeable future. And I believe that, you know, we're seeing, you know, to a certain extent, maybe not as widely, but also taking place out in the western part of Australia in relation to our rail business as well. And so I think, you know, over the next couple of years, we should, you know, continue to see, you know, higher volumes and higher utilization for both businesses, and obviously subject to, you know, where the commodity prices trade. I think... As far as, you know, major expansions, my view is that, you know, most of those, you know, are probably on the shelf for the time being until we see some price signals that would suggest that they would make sense. And so, you know, in relation to, you know, Dudgeon Point, you know, at this stage, you know, we are still pretty much pens down as relates to that particular large-scale expansion project. What we are doing, though, and what we've been thinking about for the last couple of quarters is some, you know, smaller, more incremental type expansions that we can do at DBCT itself. And so, you know, the first phase might be, you know, a 4 or 5 million ton expansion, and then we've got, you know, some ideas around maybe how we can do a 15 or 20 million ton expansion. But they're much more, you know, smaller and incremental than Dudgeon Point, which would be, you know, in relation to you know, much greater growth, which we just don't see at this point in time.
Okay, that's helpful. So it sounds like, you know, kind of similar to what you guys put in place this quarter. I think it was $50 million of additional at the DBCT. And then just my second question, last question for Bahir. So just thinking about the capital backlog now, the growth CapEx projects. They're about, I think it's about $900 million, kind of give or take. I forget if that's sort of a number through the end of 2015 or if that's a 24-month window. And how should we think about the ability to finance that on a leverage-neutral basis through your cash flow and what that may mean for the dividend? Because if I think about just a high-level BIP perspective, your AFFO less the dividend is sort of in the low $200 millions, which would suggest to me that maybe funding this internally from just operating cash flow on a leverage-neutral basis, call it 50-50 debt to equity, or maybe even 60-40, seems like you may fall a little bit shy. So just wondering, with the increase in the CapEx backlog, does that mean you've got to look for some additional sources to help fund that on a leverage-neutral basis?
Sure. Thanks. Hey, Brendan. Thanks for that. So, as you said, there's about $930 million of total CapEx in our backlog, including about $35 million in energy projects, and if you add that to our utilities and transport numbers that we disclose in our supplemental, you get about $930 million. These numbers will be invested over the next 2 to 3 years. As you correctly pointed out, they will be funded, say, on average by 50%. Typically, your utilities projects will be funded with 60 to 65% debt, and the transport and energy projects will be funded by, say, 40 to 50% debt to equity. So on average, you're right, about 50%. And so over 3 years, and if I look out to our forecasted results and just keeping with sort of our methodology of retaining 20% of the FFO that we generate in our business, retaining that back into our business and reinvesting in these projects, we don't think we will be in need of any fresh new capital. And that's also in addition to about $760 million of retained cash that's in the business that today we have. So we do have currently a lot of cash in the business, and in addition to that, in the next 3 years, we'll be generating some pretty good cash flow that will be sufficient to fund this approximately $930 million CapEx backlog.
Yeah, maybe just to add to that, a significant amount of this backlog relates to our Brazilian toll roads, where we have lines of credit with BNDES specifically set aside for these expansion projects, as well as a significant amount of cash that we have pre-funded that sits down there as well to fund the CapEx. So, that probably skews the numbers a bit, but most of that CapEx has already been pre-funded through those two mechanisms.
Okay. All right. Very helpful. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Brendan.
The next question is from Andrew Kuske of Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. I just want to sort of step back a little bit and think about your capital allocation on a global basis and how you're thinking about just some of the currency moves we've seen recently. So you've seen the euro pull back a little bit. Some of the LATAM currencies are still somewhat depressed relative to where they were a few years ago. So how do you think about that in terms of allocating your dollars on a, say, the next few years relative to, say, quote-unquote, more normalized levels of some of those currencies?
Hi, Andrew. As it relates to currencies themselves, we take a much longer term view when thinking about where they sit at this particular point in time. I think whenever we make an investment, long term growth rates, inflation, and currencies are all factors that go into our underwriting analysis. But I'd say, you know, the currency side of it is one that, you know, if we think that we're sitting outside of a particular band, then we'll usually cover that off through, you know, some sort of hedging activity. You know, particularly as it relates to European, the euro or the UK pound, where, you know, we can almost always hedge that out at very low cost if we think that they're trading outside of what we would describe as a normal band. South America is obviously, you know, a little different, but, you know, today I'd say we think that the currencies down there are probably fairly attractively priced, and you know, putting aside all other factors, it would be a relatively good entry point to go into that market. But you know, I think you know, just sort of maybe adding to your question a little bit, you know, we see good putting aside valuation for the time being. We see good conditions for investing across the world. Our two most active regions, you know, at the moment are probably Europe and then maybe to a lesser extent Australia. And then we've got a number of, you know, I'd say more early stage opportunities that we're evaluating here in North America and in South America. But all in all, we've got good good pipeline around the world.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, and then if we focus on the European situation, really, what are the primary drivers of some of the opportunities you're seeing? Is it corporate deleveraging, or is it effectively bank deleveraging, trying to get off of some loans on their books?
It's both, you know, to be honest. The theme is definitely deleveraging, though. You know, we... you know, with where the bank market is today in Europe, you know, there's some opportunities that unfortunately have gone away from us because, you know, companies have been able to blend and extend to a certain extent. But, you know, generally people are either taking advantage of this point in time to sell assets to help pay down debt, or banks are giving them a bit of a push. And so that is creating opportunities for us.
Okay, that's very helpful. And then if I may just ask one more specific question as it relates to some of your co-investor interests in some of the assets, and say Translect in particular. I think if we looked at that asset, it's probably the one that's been on the Brookfield books the longest. And so the ownership positions there, are they coming up to the end of life of the original life of the fund before they go into the option periods? And then what does that really mean from a BIP standpoint on an opportunity to increase the capital position allocated to those assets?
So in relation to Translect, that was an investment we've made with you know, three institutional partners going back probably to 2005. At the time, it wasn't really a fund per se. It was more of a joint venture type arrangement. It doesn't really have a specific termination period, and so, you know, the exit decisions are really dependent on each individual partner's investment horizon. And so, you know, we know our partners like that asset as much as we do, and so I'm not expecting that anyone's looking to exit anytime soon.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
The next question is from Robert Kwan with RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Just when it comes to GDP-driven investments, it seems that those fit your long-term thesis quite well, and generally that leads you to the transport business and maybe a little bit more away from the utilities business. I'm just wondering how you think about balancing the percentage of the investment from each of those different asset classes, if you do at all, and if you do have some targets, what type of goalposts are you looking at in terms of balancing the two?
Hi, Robert. You know, we don't have any specific objectives around or targets around balancing one asset class to another. I'd say our investment philosophy has always been much more opportunistic, and we have just found that over the last 12 to 24 months that the better value opportunities for us have been in the more GDP sensitive businesses, because people have been paying an extremely high valuation for contracted cash flows, which I think we see both in the public markets and in the private markets. But cycles change. I think once interest rates move, you could see that change, and people's concerns around that could result in more opportunities for us to invest in utility type transactions. Obviously, we're able to add to our utilities business through our capital backlog, and so they continually organically grow and make up a meaningful portion of our organic growth. And even though we may not do as many utility type transactions, we are continuing to seek them out, and we will from time to time make investments, and often they can be large. So it's probably a long-winded answer for what you asked, but I think the short answer is there is no target, and I think you need to look at our investment program over a much longer term time frame than just the last 12 to 24 months.
Okay. And if it's just to be clear, if it's not necessarily between utilities and, say, transport or energy as well, is there a level of exposure to just GDP-driven assets that would get you uncomfortable?
I don't think so, and I apologize if there's noise in the background here. We've got the air conditioner on in the room here. I think the thing you need to keep in mind, Robert, is that even for our GDP-sensitive businesses, they're all highly contracted and or regulated entities. And so, you shouldn't necessarily conclude that that the cash flows have a lot of volatility to them. Examples such as our district energy business, which we might describe as GDP sensitive, because a lot of our new contracts come on, or new customers come on, because of new buildings that are built. And so it has a sensitivity to the economy, but besides that, all of our existing customer base is locked in for 20 to 30 years, and the cash flows are to a large extent indexed to inflation. So, I think it's just you need to be careful in concluding that GDP sensitive is volatile. That doesn't necessarily mean that.
Okay. Just, I guess, the last question here. When it comes to your UK regulated distribution business, you cited the multi-product offering. Is that just the fiber side that Enexis brought to you, or is there something else? And is this selling additional services to existing customers, or is this more driven by an expansion of the footprint, just offering more services as you roll that out?
So, today we have five products. Two we had prior to the acquisition of Enexis. So we always had gas and electricity, and those still remain the main multi-product offerings that we sell to customers. Since the acquisition of Enexis, we added three new products. One is fiber to the home, one is water, and the last one is district energy. District energy, typically sells on its own, because it targets a different type of residential property. But you know, we could and do in fact offer the other four to our customers. And I'd say we have water is a much more niche, smaller product for us, but the one that is continuing to grow, albeit it will take some time before I'd say it's hugely meaningful for our results, but fiber to the home is probably the one we're most excited about. But today, you know, gas and electricity are very established, and I'd say in most cases we sell both of those to our customers and when we do a sale.
And what's the fiber penetration rate to the existing customers, i.e. how much running room do you have for kind of above average growth as you sell through to the existing customers?
Well, today the penetration is quite modest, and in fact, you know, because of the you know, relative infancy of the regulation around it, from a profitability perspective, it really only is economic for customers with larger entitlement schemes. And so we're hoping that with you know, further work that we'll do with the regulator, where we can improve our access points, that we in fact can make this more economic to much smaller schemes, and then our penetration will rise substantially. But it's still relatively new. I think this is something that hopefully we'll be able to provide you greater transparency on over the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Sam.
Okay, thank you.
The next question is from Bert Powell with BMO Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Good morning, Sam and Bahir. Just a question on the toll roads. $341 million is your capital backlog, and I'm going to assume most of that is for Brazil. And I'm just wondering, can you walk us through how that capital goes in and the lag between the increasing and widening of lanes then turns into FFO? I would assume increasing a road, you can start tolling right away. Widening is a judgment call around, you know, utilization of the toll roads. I'm just wondering if you could help us think about, you know, how that the return on that capital flows.
Okay, there's really two elements to it, Bert. The first element relates to you know, higher tariffs that we get from what they describe as rebalancing, which is where when we expend the capital, you know, the regulator will you know, allow us to adjust our models where we can increase tariffs, and that obviously gets collected over the life of the concession. And so it's somewhat of a mathematical analysis that we do with the regulator, but it would be over, you know, let's say the remaining 20 years of the concession. And then, so that's a, you know, obviously a very large component to it. The second component, which you know, can happen relatively quickly, is that you know, when we do an expansion and de-bottleneck a road, there's often sort of a step change increase in volumes that takes place, and this can happen, you know, quite quickly following one of these widenings. You know, and they're very specific examples, but we have a number of roads, you know, such as Regis Bittencourt, which is one of the roads that connects Sao Paulo with Curitiba. And, you know, there's a couple of choke points where, you know, traffic is extremely dense, and as a result, it just discourages people from making the trip. But once you've completed an expansion, you know, what we've seen in other roads is that the experience of traveling from A to B becomes, you know, that much better, that it just results in people now making that trip, whereas today the only people who would take the road were the people who, you know, just, you know, must use it. And so, you know, that's obviously hard to predict. as far as, you know, what the quantum of that will be. But, you know, those are really the two examples of how it takes place.
Okay, that's great. That gives a little bit of color on that front. And just wondering, in terms of your ports commentary, I assume most of that relates to PD ports, but how are Euro ports doing outside of the PD ports?
I'll start on this one, and you know, Bahir can jump in as well. You know, you're correct in your first statement that you know, the stronger of the operations has been our UK operation, where we have you know, really seen a change in the economic situation in the UK over the last, you know, 6 to 12 months. I think it really started in the fourth quarter of last year, and has really carried through to this year, and it looks quite promising for the next little while. You know, the experience in Euroports and in the European continent is, I'd say, mixed. You know, there is, as far as, you know, trade goes, you know, we're starting to see some improvement, albeit lower than what we have seen in the UK. But, you know, it's a much more diverse business, and so there's always, you know, specific situations such as, you know, weather conditions in Spain that you know, can impact the amount of generation that comes through hydro versus coal generation, and whether or not the coal plants are operating. And if the coal plants are operating, then there's reduced coal imports, and which is what we've seen, and that's, you know, impacted our numbers. And so it's harder to draw a comparison on the economic conditions of Europe with our operations specifically. But, you know, I think our business in Europe as a whole has been very steady, and you know, we're expecting that you know, with the better economy, and then hopefully none of this noise with weather or whatever, you know, will result in better results over the next couple of years.
Yeah, and Bert, I'll just add to that. So volumes have stabilized, as Sam said, so at the EBITDA level. We're essentially flat to slightly up year over year, and we get more benefit at the FFO line item. Just you'll recall that financing that we did last year, where we deleveraged the business and also reduced our cost of carry there. So as volumes ramp up in the next little while, we'll also get that added benefit as well, because our FFO there is going to pick up additionally just because of the financing that we did.
Okay. And Bahir, just while I got you, last question on other income in the corporate side. You kind of a better than expected quarter there. Can you, is there anything that you can call out to say that this is a normal level, or you know, what are the one-timers that are contributing to that in the quarter, if there's any?
Sure. So Bert, we've got about it ranges between $275 million to $325 million. That's the total size of the investment program. From a current yield perspective, we target 4 to 5%. Returns, and from a total return perspective, we're targeting 8 to 10% percent returns. During the quarter, you're right, it was, you know, income was $10 million. I would say that's a little bit outsized, as we did realize on some gains on certain positions that we sold during the quarter. But so on a normalized basis, I think modeling a 4 to 5% current yield on that investment program will be good, realizing that in certain quarters we could surprise on the upside if we did realize on any positions.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you.
The next question is from Frederick Bastian, with Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Good morning, guys. You mentioned that sales activity was up 40% for your UK regulated business, but I suspect this is probably coming off a low base. Can you provide more color on the strength you're actually observing and whether we can expect this improved sales activity to have somewhat of a material impact on your results in the second half?
Hi, Frederick. You know, I'd say that you know the real driver for the sales activity has been the improvement in the economy of the UK and in particular in home building. We had I think some slight benefit this quarter because of some pricing changes that we were going to institute in the fall, and so my understanding was some of the developers advanced some of the sales to lock in that price. But generally, our expectation is that the housing starts in the UK will remain strong, for the foreseeable future. There's still, as we mentioned in our remarks, at levels below what we would describe as steady state. I don't expect that our market share will drop or increase, from the levels we're at now. And so I think we're at a level of penetration that's pretty sustainable.
Okay, thanks. The second question I have regards NGPL, there has been little mention of it today. Has your view on the business changed fundamentally?
The short answer is no. The I think what has changed from quarter to quarter. Last quarter, we talked about how with the extremely cold and long winter that we had that. Storage levels had dropped to the lowest level we'd seen in, I think, in history. And so we were predicting that it was unlikely that we would see injection levels, take storage levels back up to where they were at the end of last year. And so we probably could have, greater volatility and higher prices, which would all be great for our business. As you know, the summer has seen very temperate weather conditions in the Northeast, and injection levels as a result have exceeded what we probably would have expected a few months ago. And so while storage levels probably won't get back up to where they were, I don't think they're going to be at the drastically low levels that we and others were predicting. And so, I think we're probably in for another year of relatively modest volatility. Obviously, we hope that I'm wrong and that there'll be better volatility. But unless we get some real scorching weather soon, my expectation is that we'll probably see gas prices and volatility at levels that maybe are a little better, but comparable to what we've seen in the last couple of years.
Okay, thanks, Sam. That's helpful. Thank you.
The next question is from Cherilyn Radbourne of TD Securities. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. Good morning. First question is just on VLI and the $300 million of growth projects there. I assume that that's at share, and I was just curious over what time frame you'd expect to deploy that capital.
Hi, Cherilyn. To answer your first question, yes, that's our share. I think for the whole business, it's a very substantial program of about 6 to 7 billion RIAs. The time frame for completing all the projects, is anywhere between 5 and 7 years. And so, the 300 million that we spoke about, really relates to that, 5 to 7 year time horizon. Our expectation is that a good chunk of that will be at the front end, but we haven't yet had an official board meeting, and so, the exact timing of those programs, we still need to work out with management and our partners. But that hopefully gives you a bit of a sense of how those numbers fit in.
Okay, and just to come back to the currency discussion earlier in the call, you do continue to be well hedged on your non-Latin American currency exposures, and I'm just curious why you aren't hedging the Latin American exposure, whether that's a cost issue to your earlier point or a view on the currencies or both.
It's primarily a cost issue. I think we've seen some pretty substantial corrections to date, and most of the currencies are within a band that we think is relatively what we describe as normal, and so our treasury group while obviously cautious about the environment, nonetheless recommend that we maintain the current stance.
Okay, and then last one for me. You do note in your commentary that the use of leverage and valuation multiples on some recent deals has approached prior peak levels, and I think we're all aware of some of those examples. Just curious how vulnerable you think some of these deals are to a change in economic conditions or interest rates or both, and are we setting ourselves up for another period of distress at some point?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, so I can't say how things will unfold. And there's no doubt that some of the transactions have been fueled by higher debt levels. But, I'd say if there is a silver lining, it's the fact that most of the higher valuations have been funded from equity, and as a result of new entrants using lower return expectations than they would in the past. So I think there is a risk that for some of those investors who will need to realize on their investments in the short term, that they could experience losses. But I think some of them also are long-term investors, and they may, in fact, hold on to their assets for a much longer time horizon. And so, we won't really see the impact of those results. I think it'll be the equivalent of them having bought long-term bonds and just having to wear the mark-to-market losses. But at this stage, I can't predict any sort of negative systemic issues that might come out of this higher valuation period.
Thank you. That's all from me.
Okay. Thank you very much.
There are no more questions at this time. I will now turn the call back over to Mr. Pollack for closing comments.
That's great. Thank you, operator, and thank you for everyone on the call for participating today. And we look forward to speaking with you again next quarter and reviewing our progress. Have a nice summer.
This concludes today's conference call. You may disconnect your lines. Thank you for participating, and have a pleasant day.